Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Scott Gregory, sitting in today for Rich Fisher. Last month, April, was National Poetry Month, and a fine month it was. But today, in the merry month of May, we've got a great discussion with a poet visiting Tulsa tomorrow night. John Brehm, born and raised in Nebraska, living for many years in New York, and now based in Portland, Oregon, will do a reading here in Tulsa tomorrow night at the Joseph Garrick Fine Art Gallery on Cherry Street, beginning at 7 p.m. John Brehm is a poet who's got a new book out called Help Is On The Way and an earlier book, Sea of Faith, his first book, both of them from the University of Wisconsin Press, both of them award-winning volumes of poetry. And he's our guest today, as I say. His poems have appeared in Poetry, the Gettysburg Review, the Southern Review, Boulevard, Gulf Coast, This Land, the Missouri Review, and elsewhere. He's also, John Brehm, the associate editor of the Oxford Book of American Poetry, which came out in 2006. Here's a taste of his work. This is from the new collection, again called Help Is On The Way. This is a poem called Revelation. My memory is like a steel-toothed trap, and my memories like bewildered animals, lured from the thick of the forest by strong scents and caught here now, howling and bitten with regret for all their innocence, their stupidity, their hunger, and their great mistakes. In the morning I will gather them, club them if they are not yet dead, skin them and stitch them into a coat, to keep myself warm and admired and concealed. Very well-executed metaphor at work through the whole of that poem. Again, the poem is Revelation from the new book by John Brehm. Help Is On The Way. Brehm is our guest today here on Studio Tulsa. John Brehm, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks for joining us today.
I'm very happy to be here, Scott.
We're looking forward to your reading here in Tulsa, and I'd like to talk about both of the books you have out, the new book called Help Is On The Way and the earlier book from about 04, I think, called Sea of Faith.
Right. I'll be reading from both those books.
How did you start writing poetry? Do you remember how you started writing poems?
Yeah, you know, I always had kind of an artistic bent. And when I was younger, I thought I would be a visual artist. And I spent sort of all my free time drawing. And then when I got to high school and started working with oil paints, it kind of stopped me. And then I realized, I kind of discovered that I had this inner life that no one in my family had mentioned or acknowledged.
You grew up in Lincoln, Nebraska.
I grew up in Lincoln, Nebraska, in a very working-class family. So my father worked in a factory. My mother didn't work. My father dropped out of high school. Nobody in my family read poetry or was interested in literature or art or anything like that. But I always had that inclination. I'm not sure why. And then I took a poetry writing class in high school where the teacher just let us write or daydream for an hour pretty much every day. And I thought that was pretty sweet. Then I remember I took a class as a freshman in college, and the first day the teacher asked us for a poem, and when I came back in the next class, my poem, he had mimeographed, and that's how long ago this was, and my poem was on top, and he just praised it to the skies. So that was a huge thrill for me. And I remember going into his office afterwards and saying, you know, I'm not just taking your class. This is what I want to do with my life, you know, making this big declaration.
Yeah, how did that go over? What did the teacher say? Do you remember?
Well, I mean, I remember he was happy. Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, because a lot of people took his class because it was easy. Like, you didn't have to write papers.
Sure, right.
To take tests.
There are no wrong answers.
Right. Yeah, anybody can write poems.
Yeah.
As we all know. So I think he was excited to have somebody who you know, was really dedicated and interested. And that was a great relationship. His poet named Greg Kuzma, who's very encouraging to me. So that's kind of the external situation. Internally, you know, my family was not real communicative emotionally. And so for me, poetry was this wonderful way into the inner life and working with my emotional life.
Right. And it sounds like you were taking it fairly seriously early on. Like a lot of people, you know, like you said, take the poetry class because it's a blow-off class or it seems like something that'll be easy to do and, you know, may or may not be interesting or especially creative for that person. But for you, you were sort of serious about it early on.
Yeah, I was very
serious. Had you read a lot of poems?
Well, not really. But when I got into college, you know, I started reading more poems, and you know, I started reading poets like William Carlos Williams, and then Ted Kooser.
From Nebraska.
Yeah, and he was really popular. And I actually still like his early work. I don't really like his later work, but anyway, he, you know, and he was writing about Nebraska, which was something that I thought, you know, couldn't be done because it seemed like, you know, a dull place to be. And but what I discovered was that when I did start writing, I started noticing all these things about Nebraska that became really interesting to me because I was paying attention to them in a different way. And it was a good thing for me, anyway, that my family was not encouraging me to write poetry. I mean, it was something I did kind of to define myself against them or the way they lived or that way of being in the world.
Right, so, very much a move of, like, adolescence.
Yeah, kind of rebellious, but certainly like a, it was like a secret world that I felt that I could retreat into.
Right.
And I didn't want a lot of... I mean, you didn't go around, you know, saying, I'm a poet, you know, in Lincoln, Nebraska at that time. So it was kind of good. It was a good situation for me.
I've noticed in the two books, and we'll talk about them individually and comparatively, but I've noticed one thing off the bat is that there's this transition, well, sort of you going from being a teacher who also writes poetry to a poet who doesn't really care for teaching anymore or doesn't do it anymore. Did you just go into teaching as that's what poets do to make a living?
Yeah, basically, I didn't know what else to do.
Right.
You know, and it was just kind of what everybody did, which is not a great reason to do it. But, and I really enjoyed teaching. I loved it. But I always felt uneasy in academia, and I never really saw myself as, you know, teaching in an MFA program and having that kind of be my whole life. So I always kind of had one foot out the door, even though I loved teaching very much. But yeah, it was just kind of the presumptive job to have.
Let's pause here and, if you don't mind, read, if you could read Sea of Faith from the book by that title.
Sure, that's about teaching. That's a poem that I wrote, well, it's the experience described in the poem. It's when I was teaching my first teaching job, which was at Emerson College. And I was teaching a very ambitious syllabus. It's called Sea of Faith. Once, when I was teaching Dover Beach to a class of freshmen, a young woman raised her hand and said, I'm confused about this Sea of Faith. Well, I said, let's talk about it. We probably need to talk a bit about figurative language. What confuses you about it? I mean, is it a real sea? She asked. You mean, is it a real body of water that you could point to on a map or visit on a vacation? Yes, she said. Is it a real sea? Oh, Christ, I thought. Is this where we are? Next year, I'll be teaching them the alphabet and how to sound words out. I'll have to teach them geography, apparently, before we can move on to poetry. I'll have to teach them history, too. A few weeks on the Dark Ages might be instructive. Yes, I wanted to say, it is. It is a real sea. In fact, it flows right into the sea of ignorance in which you are drowning. Let me throw you a rope of salvation before the sharks of desire gobble you up. Let me hoist you back up onto the ship of fools so that we might continue our search for the fountain of youth. Here, take a drink of this. It's fresh from the river of forgetfulness. But of course, I didn't say any of that. I tried to explain in such a way as to protect her from humiliation, tried to explain that poets often speak of things that don't exist. It was only much later that I wished I could have answered differently, only after I'd betrayed myself and been betrayed, that I wished it was true, wished there really was a sea of faith that you could wade out into, dive under its blue and magic waters, hold your breath, swim like a fish down to the bottom, and then emerge again, able to believe in everything, faithful and unafraid to ask even the simplest of questions, happy to have them simply answered.
Great poem. Wonderful poem. And I love how you get so much mileage out of taking all those metaphors literally.
Right.
Ship of fools, sea of faith, of course, fountain of youth. And John, I was wondering, do you begin writing with a metaphor in mind often? Or do you begin rather with a story to tell or a sketch to execute, a profile to render, you know?
You know, that's a good question, and it varies. Sometimes there is an experience that I want to write about, and it's the experience that itself that's pressing itself forward, and then you just have to find the language to try to work with it. And then other times, I'll just, you know, have a line or a metaphor, and I decide to run with it. And then other times, I mean, there's a poem in the first book called Postcard from the Heartbreak Hotel.
Yeah.
And that was a case where I was just thinking, well, what would that hotel be like if it actually existed?
I mean, you heard the Elvis song and went with that?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, okay.
And I just thought, well, what would that, you know, what kind of food would they serve you?
Yeah.
What would the, disposition of the hotel staff be like?
The bellhop.
Yeah. I like taking metaphors or sometimes even cliches and making them real, you know, trying to sort of concretize them. And
I guess that's something that poetry has always done or at least tried to do.
Yeah.
Take a scalpel to language in that way.
Yeah, or there's the Shakespeare line, to give to airy nothings a local habitation and a name.
Right.
You know, to take what's abstract and somehow make it more real, which is, you know.
Is that something that you admired about the poets you read early on when we were talking about how you got started in poetry, reading it, writing it?
Yeah, metaphor was the thing. I mean, Kuser, his early work anyway, is really vivid and lots of arresting, you know, metaphors. And that's something that I think we all kind of respond to. And it's that sense that, you know, of seeing some likeness between apparently dissimilar things. That has a certain kind of charge. I mean, there must be some synaptic thing that happens in the brain when you make that connection that is really pleasurable and engaging, and especially if it's a sort of surprising metaphor. So, yeah, I did. That was one of the things that first drew me to poetry or got me excited about poetry.
You know, it just occurred to me, I was thinking about your metaphors, your writing, and we were talking about how you're from Nebraska. You write about the wind a lot.
Metaphorically
and sort of naturally or realistically. I mean, both.
Yeah. You know, somebody pointed that out to me before, and I honestly, it hadn't occurred to me how much of that is in actually both of these
books.
Yes,
yes, very much so.
Particularly the first book. And,
you're in Tornado Alley.
Yeah, right.
Or you were, like we are here in Oklahoma.
That's true, although Lincoln happens to be in a valley, so it never really gets hit by tornadoes.
Okay.
You always had the warnings and stuff, and I did see a couple tornadoes when I was a kid, and it was, yeah, you were certainly aware of them, but I don't know, I remember Richard Hugo said something about the wind a long time ago that struck me. He said the wind, you know, is like God because we feel its presence, but it's invisible, or something like that.
And that very really, famous poet, writing instructor, Richard Hugo.
Yeah, and that intrigued me, so I think there's some metaphysical quality about the wind that is appealing to me.
We were going to talk a little bit about the relationship between the two books. Help is on the Way is the new book, and the earlier volume, Sea of Faith, they're both from the University of Wisconsin Press. One thing that sets the new book apart is that there are these very long poems.
Right.
Talk about starting to write long poems.
Yeah, that is one of the distinguishing features. There are two long poems in Help is on the Way. One is 9 pages, and one is 17 pages. And
had you done that before?
No, I had never even attempted a long poem before. I think the longest poem I'd written before that was, you know, maybe just barely 3 pages or two and a half or something. And yeah, Lineage, I mean, that, I don't know, that poem just, I'm still not sure how that came to be. But, you know, I just started writing it, and there just seemed to be more and more, and I seemed to make more connections, and everything I was reading seemed to funnel into the poem.
I was going to say, it's sort of a sequence of lyrics. It's not one long narrative spiel going for X number of pages, but rather, right. A collection of poems that could sometimes stand on their own.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, there are these kind of narrative threads, not narrative threads, but thematic threads that run through them, but they're separate. I mean, they're discrete. But yeah, it's partly a poem about the evolution of human emotions, it's about fear, it's about the evolution of art, it's about Buddhism, it's about about a lot of things.
Lions roaming the savannas of Africa.
Yeah, and that's what started the poem. I was reading this book called A General Theory of Love, which is about human emotions, and the idea that the emotional part of the brain really hasn't changed very much in like 5 million years. So that part of the brain really started to evolve when we came down from the trees onto the open savannas, came down from the relative safety of the trees and onto this really terrifying environment where you were, dealing with lions and other predators and relatively, defenseless. And it struck me as, wow, that's when the emotional part of the brain was evolved. And so that just seemed a really rich thing to kind of try to explore. So I tried to imagine what it must have felt like to live with the constant threat of lions and other predators. And that's kind of what sparked the poem. Yeah.
If you don't mind, I'd like you to read from that long poem, Lineage, from your new book, Help is on the Way. And if you could, maybe sections 11, 12, 13, 14.
Yeah, starting with...
Yeah, starts on basically pages 42 and 43.
Right, okay. 11. Surface and depth. Everything is surface and depth. Without plates shifting under Earth's surface, we would not be here, which is a parable of impalpable proportions. That underlying change, changing everything. Ocean currents, planetary winds, rainfall, shrinking African forests, and forcing us down from the trees into the open. A casting out. From which follows a smarter pair of hands, an ability to plan and remember and worry, and to long for a paradise lost, a lion-free world where no one thought to cover themselves with clothing because they were already hidden, a world where fruit had hardly to be reached for, it was so plentiful, a world we are still falling from. 12. In South Africa, most hominid fossils are found in limestone caves. And do you know why? Were our ancestors wise men, hermits who sank deeply into the solitude of caves? Or were they dragged there by lions? 13. If you answered dragged there by lions, you are correct. The rise of cave-dwelling hermit monks came much later. The great Tibetan poet Milarepa lived in a cave for many years, eating nettles and meditating. Once a monster swirled its torments upon him until inspired he put his head into the demon's mouth, a practice still observable today in many circuses, and the demon disappeared. But how did it feel to sit in meditation at the site where hunger and unmindfulness so intimately met? Where real demons drag you to devour you. Well, can I understand how a religion devoted to paying attention, to being fully present, to wakefulness and impermanence would be born in such caves, among nettles and bones? 14. And how do the lions and tigers that ate our ancestors show up in Buddhist iconography? As protectors, of course. But how do you turn what you fear most into the keeper of your safety? And the answer to that question is on the next page, but I won't. You'll have to buy the book.
Exactly. Wonderful writing from the poet John Brehm. He's our guest today. You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Public Radio 89.5. I'm Scott Gregory, sitting in today for Rich Fisher. And John Brehm will be doing a reading and signing here in Tulsa tomorrow night, Saturday night, at the Joseph Garrick Fine Art Gallery on Cherry Street. And again, he is our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Fine writing there. And you write about Buddhism a lot.
Yeah, I started...
Are you a follower?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been interested in Buddhism. In fact, there's a picture of me taken in San Francisco when I was 13 with my parents, which would have been, 1969 or something, and I bought this statue of a Buddha. So I was always intrigued by it, and then about 15 years ago, I started a sitting meditation practice and started, going to Dharma talks, and I've done silent meditation retreats, and it's been a pretty important part of my life and my way of being in the world, and so this poem reflects that interest.
Right, and I think you're referring to Buddhism when you say, quote, a religion devoted to paying attention, to being fully present, to wakefulness and impermanence.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's almost like adhering to such Buddhist thought would be, in your case, a very writerly thing to do. It's part of who you are as a writer and as a person.
Yes. I mean, when I'm writing well, you know, and I'm sure you experience this too, you know, you're just fully present. I mean, it's such an extraordinary experience to be that engaged, and that feeling of aliveness and presence is really wonderful. And that's what Buddhist meditation practice tries to cultivate, you know, and it's hard. It's not easy to maintain that level of mindfulness, you know, in your daily life. But that is the goal, and it does seem like it fits with a poet's way of being in the world as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I just thinking of another poem we've got to do, if you don't mind, from the first book on the subject of what the Buddhists think and feel and say. Could you read When My Car Broke Down, page 17?
I'd be happy to. This is when I lived in Portland before, in the early 90s.
You live in Portland now?
Yeah, I'm in Portland now, and I lived here in the early 90s, and I decided to move back to the East Coast, and I drove all the way across country, so this is kind of about that. When my car broke down, I was somewhere in Utah or Wyoming, somewhere in the high, inhuman deserts, in the thin blue flame of wavering air, bluffs of red earth, scorched and stratified on the horizon. I had stopped to admire the desolation, to smoke a cigarette, and consider that 10,000 years ago, this was all underwater, that strange fish would have swum through the space my eyes now occupied. Before that ice, and before that something else again, unimaginably alien. The Buddhists say, first thought, best thought. But my first thought when I saw the steam billowing up from under my car was, if I just keep driving, maybe it will go away. After all, I was moving 3,000 miles, not to escape my problems, but to put a nice distance between them and me. A problem has to be fierce to travel that far. My second thought was to stare at the engine for a while. I leaned over and looked down into it as into the bowels of a ship or the cranium of some fantastic beast, and recalled how my father tried to teach me about cars. Mostly, he had me hold the light for hours, and mostly I studied the back of his head, turning over the words he said and knowing even then I'd never understand. The blood would drain from my arm, and I'd prop it up with my one free hand to keep from caving in or betraying my half-heartedness. Even then, I was hopelessly afflicted with the disease of a wandering mind. Even then, I was dreaming myself across magical landscapes, just like this, and learning all he had to teach me about standing rooted to one spot, wishing I were somewhere else.
Such a fantastic poem there, the way it moves in terms of the story. And you're stuck in one place, and yet you're not stuck in one place. It's
right.
It's a great piece.
Thank you.
You know, I enjoy so many of your poems, and I think, like so many poets writing today, we as readers come to your work, and we pretty much always, you know, for right or wrong, assume that the guy in the poem talking to us is more or less you.
Yeah.
You know, right or wrong, as I say, good or bad, that's just kind of the leap we tend to make.
Right.
And I think when you think of so many great poets, Whitman, Dickinson, Wallace Stevens, whomever, you tend to think of this certain voice, this consciousness that they had. And even if every single poem they didn't have I in it, you're still thinking of that I that they had.
Right.
You have that, and yet in the new book, there's this very long poem that's not so much about you, and it's about your nephew.
Right.
George.
Yeah. Right. Well, yeah, it's about...
Was that a change for you? Was that a different kind of thing for you to execute as a poet?
Yeah, it was. I mean, I've never written a poem like that. I've never had an experience like that.
Yeah, and I didn't know how much of that you would want to give away, but...
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say that I was a liver donor for my nephew. You know, we did a transplant, and half of my liver was removed and given to him, and this all took place in Kyoto. And so it's a very, very difficult, you know, surgery. It's an incredibly difficult situation to be in. And, I wasn't, the poems just started coming. I wasn't really intending to write about it when I did start writing. But, yeah, it is different because you're really working with this kind of enormous experience, and the focal point is really not yourself, although a lot of the poems are about me. But, yeah, that was a different experience, definitely. But I mean, you know, it is entirely true in my case that the I in my poems is me. I don't write persona poems, and my poems generally, you know, kind of deal with experiences that I've had and deal with them. You know, I tend not to make things up. My imagination kind of isn't willing to do that or doesn't work that way. So my poems really are pretty autobiographical.
And it sounds like it's sort of always been that case for you.
Yeah, it has been. And it's what I respond to most in other poets. When I get a sense of who the poet is and that's coming through in the poems, then I feel a kind of connection, emotional connection with that voice, that speaker. That's one of the things I love about Whitman.
Yeah, I was just thinking of Whitman, yeah, and that phrase he has somewhere in his poems where he says, "This hour I tell things in confidence. I might not tell everybody, but I will tell you."
Yeah, yeah, I know. It's just, it's magical, you know, and there's a kind of intimacy there,
right,
that I think it's certainly always been compelling for me. I don't really love kind of abstract or conceptual poems, a few exceptions. But yeah, that kind of emotional intimacy that can happen when you make that kind of connection with a voice in a poet is really powerful.
And it sounds like for you, that's where the feeling is.
Exactly. Yeah. And for me, you know, it's a limbic art. You know, the limbic part of the brain is the part of the brain that registers and allows for emotional connection or limbic resonance.
Okay.
And that's really what I find most compelling about poetry, when I feel that emotional connection with the poem, or when I feel that, you know, when I'm writing, you know, that's really it for me.
And that's essentially what you're hoping the reader will feel.
Yeah.
That connection.
I mean, I don't really, you know, have a hope for what the reader will feel, but that I want to connect. I mean, that's what it's about for me, is is connection.
And communicating rather than just expressing yourself.
Right, or just performing.
Right.
Or thinking in some fascinating way. But, you know, having some sort of emotional connection is what really seems most valuable to me. Yeah.
Well, John, I want to thank you for spending some time with us this morning. And we look forward to your reading here in Tulsa tomorrow night at the Joseph Garrick Fine Art Gallery on Cherry Street here in Tulsa, and thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Scott. I'm really excited to do the reading.
Poet John Brehm speaking with us by phone today on Studio Tulsa. He'll be doing a reading tomorrow night, Saturday night at 7 p.m. at the Joseph Garrick Gallery of Fine Art on Cherry Street here in Tulsa. I'm Scott Gregory, sitting in today for Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.